This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This opening music is courtesy of Joseph Martin, Professor of Music at the Lamont School of Music at Denver University. Welcome to the Poetry Corner. The opening music is the Irish folk song Danny Boy. The poem was written in 1910 by Englishman Frederick Edward Weatherly with a different melody, but it did not become popular until his sister-in-law introduced him to the tune of the Londonderry Air. It was republished in 1913 and became the soulful tune we know today. The most popular explanation of the words of the work are that they are the feelings of a parent seeing a son either go off to war or leaving home as a part of the Irish migration caused by the Great Potato Famine. In either case, it expresses the fear that a loved one may never be seen again. O Danny Boy, the pipes are calling, from glen to glen and down the mountainside. The summer's gone, and all the roses falling. It's you must go, and I must bide. But come ye back when summer's in the meadow, or when the valley's hushed and white with snow. It's I'll be here, in sunshine or in shadow. Oh, Danny boy, oh, Danny boy, I love you so. But when ye come and all the flowers are dying, if I am dead, as dead I well may be, you'll come and find the place where I am lying, and kneel and say an ave there for me. And I shall hear those soft you tread above me, and all my grave will warm and sweeter be, for you will bend and tell me that you love me, and I shall sleep in peace until you come to me. Next, from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, Paul Revere's Ride, better known as The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. Many years ago, we were taught that the events depicted in this poem were what had really happened that night in April of 1775. Current students now know that that is not quite so. For instance, Paul Revere is credited with the entire ride. In fact, he had at least two accomplices, William Dawes and Joseph Prescott. Prescott joining the group in Lexington. And of these three, only Prescott made it all the way to Concord. But these verses, penned in 1860 with the Civil War looming, still stand as a classic tribute to the American spirit. Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, if the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the North Church Tower as a signal light. One of by land and of two by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be, ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm for the country folk to be up and to arm. Then he said good night, and with a muffled oar silently rowed to the Charleston shore, just as the moon rose over the bay, where swinging wide at her moorings lay the Somerset, a British man of war. Phantom ship with each mast and spar across the moon like a prison bar, and a huge black hulk that was magnified by its own reflection in the tide. Meanwhile his friend through alley and street wanders and watches with eager ears, till in the silence around him he hears the muster of men at the barrack door, the sound of arms and the tramp of feet, and the measured tread of the grenadiers marching down to their boats on the shore. And he climbed the tower of the old North Church by the wooden stairs with a stealthy tread to the belfry chamber overhead, and startled the pigeons from their perch on the somber rafters that round them made masses and moving shapes of shade. By the trembling ladder, steep and tall, to the highest window in the wall, where he paused to listen and look down a moment on the roofs of the town, and the moonlight flowing over all. Beneath in the churchyard lay the dead in their night encampment on the hill, wrapped in silence so deep and still that he could hear, like a sentinel's tread, the watchful night wind as it went, creeping along from tent to tent, and seeming to whisper, "All is well." A moment only he feels the spell, the place and the hour and the sacred dread, the lonely belfry and the dead. For suddenly all his thoughts are bent on a shadowy something far away, where the river widens to meet the bay. A line of black that bends and floats on the rising tide like a bridge of boats. Meanwhile impatient to mount and ride, booted and spurred with a heavy stride, on the opposite shore walked Paul Revere. Now he patted his horse's side. Now he gazed at the landscape far and near, then impetuous stamped the earth and turned and tightened his saddle's girth. But mostly he watched with eager search the belfry tower of the old North Church. And it rose above the graves on the hill, lonely and spectral and somber and still. And lo, as he looks on the belfry's height, a glimmer and then a gleam of light. He springs to the saddle. The bridle he turns, but lingers and gazes till full on his sight a second lamp in the belfry burns. A hurry of hoofs in a village street, a shape in the moonlight, a bulk in the dark, and beneath, from the pebbles, in passing, a spark struck out by a steed flying fearless and fleet. That was all, and yet, through the gloom and the light, the fate of the nation was riding that night. And the spark struck out by that steed in his flight kindled the land into flame with its heat. He has left the village and mounted the steep, and beneath him tranquil and broad and deep is the mystic meeting the ocean tides, and under the alders that skirt its edge, now soft on the sand, now loud on the ledge, is heard the tramp of a steed as he rides. It was 12 by the village clock when he crossed the bridge into Bedford town. He heard the crowing of the cock and the barking of the farmer's dog, and felt the damp of the river's fog that rises after the sun goes down. It was 1 by the village clock when he galloped into Lexington. He saw the gilded weathercock swim in the moonlight as he passed, and the meeting house windows, black and bare, gaze at him with a speckled glare, as if they already stood aghast at the bloody work they would look upon. It was 2 by the village clock when he came to the bridge in Concord town. He heard the bleating of the flock and the twitter of birds among the trees, and felt the breath of the morning breeze blowing over the meadow brown. And one was safe and asleep in his bed, who at the bridge would be first to fall, who that day would be lying dead, pierced by a British musket ball. You know the rest. In the books you have read, how the British regulars fired and fled, how the farmers gave them ball for ball from behind each fence and farmyard wall, chasing the redcoats down the lane, then crossing the fields to emerge again under the trees at the turn of the road, and only passing to fire and load. So through the night rode Paul Revere, and through the night with his cry of alarm to every Middlesex village and farm, a cry of defiance and not of fear, a voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, and a word that shall echo forevermore. For borne on the night wind of the past, through all our history to the last, in the hour of darkness and peril and need, the people will awaken and listen to hear the hurrying hoofbeats of that steed and the midnight message of Paul Revere. Casey at the Bat by Ernest Lawrence Thayer. This is the poem that DeWolf Hopper made famous through innumerable recitals. There was a mighty Casey. Still during the 1940s, he was living in Washington, D.C. Mr. Casey, luminary of a minor league at the turn of the century, declares that in the poem, author Thayer has much maligned him. He was very careful to explain, a pitcher, and was never meant to hit. It looked extremely rocky for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-6 with but an inning left to play. And so when Cooney died at first and Burroughs did the same, a pallor wreathed the features of the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go, leaving there the rest with a hope which springs eternal within the human breast. When they thought if only Casey could get a whack at that, they'd put up even money with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, and likewise so did Blake. And the former was a pudding, and the latter was a fake. So on that stricken multitude a death-like silence sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and the much-despised Blakely tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and they saw what had occurred, there was Blakely safe in second, and Flynn a hug in third. Then from the glad multitude went up a joyous yell. It bounded from the mountaintop and rattled in the dell. It struck upon the hillside and rebounded on the flat, for Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No strangers in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded as he wiped them on his shirt. And while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed from Casey's eye. A sneer curls Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurling through the air, and Casey stood watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded and sped. "'This ain't my style,' said Casey. "'Strike one!' the umpire said. From the bleachers black with people there rose a sullen roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "'Kill him! Kill the umpire!' shouted someone from the stand, and as likely they had have done it, had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled rising tumult, and he bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and again the spheroid flew, but Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two!" "Fraud!" yelled the maddened thousands, and the echo answered, "Fraud!" But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold, they saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey would not let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip, his teeth are clenched with hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate, and now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go, and now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out. And now the story of another Casey, Casey Jones. Engineer John Luther Jones, called Casey because he hailed from C-A-Y-C-E, Kentucky, not Kansas City, as often reported. He made his historic run on the night of April 29, 1900, the fatal wreck occurring in the early morning hours near Vaughan, Mississippi. Wallace Sanders, an engineer wiper at Jackson, Tennessee, concocted a few crude verses telling the tale of Casey and his fate. A couple of years later, he, Lawrence Siebert, and Eddie Newton took the basic material, moved the locale westward, and fashioned the song substantially as it is now sung. Come all you rounders if you want to hear a story about a brave engineer. Casey Jones was the rounder's name. On a 6-week wheeler, boys, he won his fame. The caller called Casey at 4:30, kissed his wife at the station door, mounted to the cabin with his orders in his hand, and he took his farewell trip to the promised land. Casey Jones mounted to the cabin. Casey Jones with his orders in his hand. Casey Jones mounted to the cabin, and he took his farewell trip to the promised land. Put in your water and shovel in your coal. Put your head out the window, watch them drivers roll. A runner tells she leaves the rail because I'm 8 hours late with that Western mail. He looked at his watch, and his watch was slow. He looked at the water, and the water was low. He turned to the fireman, and he said, "We're gonna reach Frisco, but we'll all be dead. Casey Jones, going to reach Frisco. Casey Jones, but we'll all be dead. Casey Jones, going to reach Frisco. We're going to reach Frisco, but we'll all be dead." Casey pulled up that Reno hill. He cleared for the crossing with an awful shrill. The switchman knew by the engine's moan the man at the throttle was Casey Jones. He pulled up within 2 miles of the place. Number four stared him right in the face. Turned to the fireman and said, "Oh, you better jump, because there's 2 locomotives that's a-going to bump. Casey Jones, 2 locomotives. Casey Jones, that's a-going to bump. Casey Jones, 2 locomotives. There's 2 locomotives that's a-going to bump." Casey said just before he died, "There's 2 more roads that I'd like to ride." The fireman said, "What can that be?" "The Southern Pacific and the Santa Fe." Mrs. Jones sat on her bed a-sighing, just received a message that Casey was dying. Said, "Go to bed, children, and hush your crying, because you got another papa on the Salt Lake line." Mrs. Casey Jones got another papa. Mrs. Casey Jones on that Salt Lake line. Mrs. Casey Jones got another papa, and you've got another papa on that Salt Lake line. The lure of gold does strange things to some people. The next poem relates to one such thing. Written by Robert Service about the Great Northwest and the Klondike Gold Rush. Now, this poem is fiction, but the story it tells could very well have happened. The Cremation of Sam McGee. There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold, and the Arctic trails have their secret tales that could make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge I cremated Sam McGee. Now Sam McGee was from Tennessee, where the cotton blooms and blows. Why he left his home in the South to roam round the pole, God only knows. He was always cold, but the land of gold seemed to hold him like a spell. And he'd often say in his homely way that he'd sooner live in hell. On a Christmas day we were mushing our way over the Dawson Trail. Talk of your cold to the parka's fold, it stabbed like a driven nail. If our eyes we'd close and the lashes froze, so sometimes we couldn't see. It wasn't much fun, but the only one to whimper was Sam McGee. And that very night, as we lay packed tight in our robes beneath the snow, and the dogs were fed, and the stars o'erhead were dancing heel and toe, he turned to me and, "Cap," says he, "I'll cash in this trip, I guess. And if I do, I'm asking that you won't refuse my last request." Well, he seemed so low that I couldn't say no. Then he said with a sort of moan, "It's this cursed cold, and it's got right hold till I'm chilled clean through to the bone. Yet 'tain't being dead, it's my awful dread of the icy grave that pains. So I want you to swear that, foul or fair, you'll cremate my last remains." A pal's last need is a thing to heed, so I swore I would not fail. We started on at the streak of dawn, but God, he looked ghastly pale. He crouched on the sleigh and he raved all day of his home in Tennessee. And before nightfall, a corpse was all that was left of Sam McGee. There wasn't a breath in that land of death, and I hurried, horror-driven, with a corpse half hid that I couldn't get rid because of a promise given. It was lashed to the sleigh, and it seemed to say, "You may tax your brawn and brains, but you promised true, and it's up to you to cremate those last remains." Now a promise made is a debt unpaid, and the trail has its own stern code. In the days to come, though my lips were dumb, in my heart how I cursed that load. In the long, long night, by the lone firelight, while the huskies, round in a ring, howled out their woes to the homeless snows, oh God, how I loathed the thing. And every day that quiet clay seemed to heavy and heavier grow. And on I went, though the dogs were spent and the grubs were getting low. The trail was bad, and I felt half mad, but I swore I would not give in. And I'd often sing to the hateful thing, and it hearkened with a grin. till I came to the marge of Lake LaBarge, and a derelict there lay. It was jammed in the ice, but I saw in a trice it was called the Alice May. I looked at it, and I thought a bit, and I looked at my frozen chum. "Then here," said I, with a sudden cry, "is my crematorium." Some planks I tore from the cabin floor, and I lit the boiler fire. Some coal I found that was lying around, and I heaped the fuel higher. The flames just soared, and the furnace roared, such a blaze you seldom see. And I burrowed a hole in the glowing coal, and I stuffed in Sam McGee. Then I made a hike, for I didn't like to hear him sizzle so. And the heavens scowled, and the husky howled, and the wind began to blow. It was icy cold, but the hot sweat rolled down my cheeks, and I don't know why. And the greasy smoke in an inky cloak went streaking down the sky. I do not know how long in the snow I wrestled with grisly fear. But the stars came out, and they danced about ere again I ventured near. I was sick with dread, but I bravely said, "I'll just take a peek inside. I guess he's cooked, and it's time I looked." Then the door I opened wide. And there sat Sam, looking cool and calm in the heart of the furnace roar. And he wore a smile you could see a mile, and he said, "Please close that door. It's fine in here, but I greatly fear you'll let in the cold and storm. Since I left Plumtree down in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been warm." There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who boil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge. I cremated Sam McGee. Thomas Hardy, more famous for his novels like Far From the Madding Crowd and Tessa the D'Urbervilles, penned this poem entitled The Man He Killed about 1902. Had he and I but met by some old ancient inn, who should have sat us down to wet right many an apricot. But ranged as infantry and staring face to face, I shot at him as he at me, and killed him in his place. I shot him dead because he was my foe, just so. My foe, of course, he was. That's clear enough, although he thought he'd list, perhaps, offhand like just as I, who was out of work, had sold his traps. No other reason why. Yes, quaint and curious war is. You'd shoot a fellow down, you'd treat, if met, where any bar is, or help to half a crown. The next piece was written by Oliver Goldsmith in 1766. It was entitled Elegy on the Death of a Mad Dog. It was originally printed as a part of his novel The Vicar of Wakefield. It was variously interpreted as referring to some political or social philosophy that was disapproved of, but it may be just about the different morality of a man and a dog. Good people all of every sort, give ear unto my song, and if you find it wondrous short, it cannot hold you long. In Islington there was a man of whom the world might say that still a godly race he ran whene'er he went to pray. A kind and gentle heart he had to comfort friend and foes, the naked every day he clad when he put on his clothes. And in that town a dog was found, as many dogs there be, both mongrel, puppy, whelp, and hound, and curs of low degree. This dog and man at first were friends, but when a pique began, the dog, to gain some private ends, went mad and bit the man. Around from all the neighboring streets the wondering neighbors ran, and swore the dog had lost its wits to bite so good a man. The wound it seemed both sore and sad to every Christian eye, and while they swore the dog was mad, they swore the man would die. But soon a wonder came to light, and showed the rogues they lied. The man recovered of the bite, the dog it was that died. And now the story of a different type of dog from the point of view of the little boy who lost him. A Boy Speaks by Queen Bee Lister. Dear God, he was an old man dog. Here is his bowl and his pillow. We buried him this morning beneath the garden willow. If terriers go to heaven, it's raining so tonight. Please whistle, God, and pet him until he seems all right. God, if he will not eat, but maybe just stand still, please pick him up a little and talk to him until he wags his tail against you, then let him lick your chin. He was my dog, old buddy. Please, God, please take him in. Writing in the early 1900s, Edgar Guest came to be known as the People's Poet because of the homey nature of his work. And maybe one of the best examples of that is his piece entitled Home. It takes a heap of living in a house to make it home, a heap of sun and shatter, and you sometimes have to roam before you really appreciate the things you left behind and hunger for them somehow with them always on your mind. It don't make any difference how rich you get to be, how much your chairs and tables cost, how great your luxury. It ain't home to you, though it be the palace of a king, until somehow your soul is sort of wrapped round everything. Home ain't a place that gold can buy or get up in a minute. Before it's home, there's got to be a heap of living in it. Within the walls, there's got to be some babies born. And then, right there, you got to bring them up to women, good, and men. And gradually, as time goes on, you find you wouldn't part with anything they've ever used. They've grown into your heart. The old high chairs, the playthings too, the little shoes they wore. You'd hoard them, and if you could, you'd keep the thumb marks on the door. You've got to weep to make it home. You've got to sit and sigh and watch beside a loved one's bed and know that death is nigh. And in the stillness of the night to see death's angel come and close the eyes of her that smiled and leave her sweet voice dumb. For these are scenes that grip the heart, and when your tears are dried, you find the home is dearer than it was and sanctified. And tugging at ye always are the pleasant memories of her that was and is no more. You can't escape from these. You've got to sing and dance for years. You've got to romp and play and learn to love the things you have by using them each day. Even the roses round the porch might blossom year by year before they come apart of ye, suggesting someone dear who used to love them long ago and trained them just to run the way they do so they would get the early morning sun. You've got to love each brick and stone from cellar up to dome. It takes a heap of living in a house to make it home. This is Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And thank you for listening in to The Poetry Corner.